I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Was the internet. Many teenagers and young adults could be found hanging out at the mall or on the street corner, driving around or talking on the phone, watching TV or listening to music. They still do all those things, but now many of them also go online. Some of the fastest growing sites online are MySpace and Facebook. They are especially popular with adolescents and 20-somethings. These websites provide an interactive social network where users write autobiographical profiles, sometimes with a soundtrack, post photos of themselves, list their interests in education, provide a link to their friends, and have a place to leave messages. It's possible to cruise from page to page, and having done that in preparation for today's show, it's really interesting, seductive, and in some cases, eye-opening. Well, we want to explore these online communities today on Radio Times, and our lines are open, especially for those of you that use some of these services. If you've posted your own biography online, if you're heading off to college, looking for a roommate or for friends, give us a call here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We've invited two guests to join us this morning on Radio Times. Amanda Lenhardt is senior researcher at the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and she specializes in youth and their use of the internet. Amanda Lenhardt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And Fred Stutzman, also our guest. He's a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. His research focuses on social networking, and he's the co-founder of Claim ID Project, the Claim ID Project, which helps people manage what is written about them online. And Fred Stutzman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Amanda, let me begin with you. Why are these sites so popular? And when you look at how they have gained in popularity, it's really exponential, extraordinary.
Sure. I think there's sort of two main parts of the sites that I think keep people coming back. It's simultaneously this idea that you can post both personal information about yourself, but expressive content. You can post your favorite song. You can post poems. You can post pictures. You can share yourself with the world. The other part is that you can also connect that expression and that profile with all other people, and you can see this network made visible and then also get feedback about how you show yourself and the things that you share from that network of friends.
You want to add anything to that, Fred? And I just have to underscore the fact that, I mean, it was really fun preparing for the show and checking out all these various sites and, you know, following people's network of friends. How do you see the popularity, Fred?
Well, I think you've sort of hit it right on the head. People are very interesting to other people. And when you're a younger person and you're sort of building your social network, it's very interesting to go out and explore those around you. And I think that's what we see a lot of these people doing, just using these sites to not only put their identity out there, but to explore the world around them. It's very interesting to them.
And let me go back to you, Amanda Lenhardt, because we were focusing primarily, but not exclusively, on MySpace and Facebook. How are those different?
Well, they are different, actually. MySpace is more of what might be termed an open system. MySpace, anyone can join MySpace. There are some age restrictions, but they're hard to enforce, so there tends to be a really quite a broad variety of ages, from, you know, middle schoolers and elementary schoolers to adults. MySpace also allows you to really modify your page on MySpace. You can really change how it looks. You can add a lot of material. Facebook, on the other hand, is what might be termed more of a closed system. It's not a perfectly closed system, but in order to join MySpace, you have to have, on the university level or college level, an EDU account, an account that ends with your sort of school email address.
Let me just jump in there. You're talking about Facebook, right?
I'm talking about Facebook.
Yes.
Is the second one, more closed system. For high schools, it's a little bit more open, but you have to be allowed in by somebody else who already goes to your high school. So the idea being that you more of a known quantity in terms of who your network is. And also Facebook, while you can post photos and you can post links to other material, there's less of an integration with sort of, you can't change your Facebook page as much as you can with MySpace. It's a little bit less creative.
Do you see creative differences, Fred, when you look at MySpace and Facebook?
Definitely. I almost see them as two separate worlds. What you can do in MySpace in terms of creating a truly sort of unique identity is almost limitless because of the way that you can change your profile and bring in pictures and media and that sort of thing. Whereas in Facebook, it is more, it is a little bit more conservative, a little bit more guarded. There's only so much you can share. But I think an interesting sort of point to all of this is Facebook is so interesting to people because when young people go to college, they have this, they have to explore the world around them. They have to meet all these new friends. And even though the Facebook, Facebook isn't open to the entire world,
right.
It's open to the world that's around them that they're interested in. So even though they can't be as expressive as they are in MySpace, it still satisfies a real core need.
And you found, Fred, that freshmen going to college are big users. In fact, that's where this this interest in Facebook really gets started.
That's right. I really see the freshmen in college as sort of the core feeder audience of the Facebook because I think they're the ones that need it the most. These sites are fun, and you know they're places where people's friends are on. And it's fun to browse them and all that stuff. But they actually give utility. There's utility to these sites, and when you meet, you know, 300, 500 new people a semester through your classes and your clubs, that sort of thing, you actually do want to go out and explore them and see, I just met this person. I want to know more about them. And that actually is just such a experience that I think is a transformative experience for these freshmen because they go out and they explore everyone around them. It really has changed college, I think.
And do you also think, Fred, that the people that use Facebook look down on people that use MySpace? Is there a snob appeal?
Well, I don't have any scientific facts about that, but I do get that feeling. And I think it's the fact that the Facebook sort of represents this walled garden, you know, this place where you have to be a member of the club to get in, whereas MySpace is the mall. You know, anybody can be there. And I think there's obviously going to be some differences in opinion and how those two things are looked at.
I wonder to you, Amanda Lenhart, for people that go to these sites, are we seeing then how teenagers and young adults talk to each other, talk about themselves when adults are not supposed to be watching or listening?
I think that's really a great point. I think some of the, you know, certainly there's, we would be remiss if we didn't mention that there's been a great deal of sort of concern about some of these sites, particularly for young people. And I think a lot of that does come from the fact that now, and I think this also applies to blogs as well, now a lot of what we see in terms of the interaction of teens with peers is a lot more transparent and visible to adults who previously might not have been privy to these kinds of conversations. They might have occurred in, you know, the locker room or the girls' bathroom or when teens were away and off doing their own thing, when they were, you know, fairly certain they wouldn't be overheard. But now I think there's this online place where teens are expressing themselves and they're doing it without a lot of I'm struggling for the words here, but they're not necessarily, I think, always thinking about who the full audience might be.
Well, I think that gets to an important issue, and it's certainly clear when you go to these sites is this melding of the public and the private space. I mean, these are young people expressing themselves, but expressing themselves to the entire world, potentially.
Well, you know, this is exactly a problem that even adults have when dealing with these online places. Think about blogs as well.
Sure.
You know, while you understand intellectually and sort of that this is a public act that you are committing, this is a public thing that you are doing, I think there's another part of a person's mind that believes in sort of the safety in numbers. Like, well, nobody's really going to find me. My parents won't be able to track me down. You know, my boss is never going to figure out my username. And that you do have sort of a sense of safety in numbers and that you also believe, I think people have ideas in their mind of who their audience really is, and often that is totally unrelated to who is actually looking. But that's how I think people talk to themselves when they start creating narratives about how they're using these sites.
Same kind of question to you, Fred Sutzman. I mean, I guess what we're talking about then is this distinct digital culture then.
That's right. And I completely agree with Amanda's point. I think that people do sort of rationalize themselves, well, safety in numbers. And there's another part of it, though. And I actually think that, say, if you're a college freshman and you didn't want to be a member of the Facebook, you'd lose out. So there are real incentives to become part of this system and to share information. And one of the things that I've seen is that the information is shared at sort of extraordinary levels, and information that we might not share on sort of a normal day-to-day basis, things like our political orientation or sexual orientation, that sort of thing. But when you think about it, if you're trying to fit your identity into 13 or 15 little forms, students are expressive. Students want to put as much out there about them to make themselves different, to show that they're individuals. And to do that, I think they actually have to take part in the system where they share a lot of information about themselves.
Amanda, though, does that open them up to, you know, the potential dangers of a predator online?
I mean, certainly there are risks anytime you post information publicly, just as if you post something on a bulletin board at the grocery store with your phone number. It's a similar sort of, in some ways, even more public act to post things on these networks. But I wanted to get back to something that Fred said.
Sure.
About presenting, about sort of sharing yourself on the internet and putting up all this information. Much of the work of being a young person is figuring out who you are and showing yourself to other people and getting feedback on that presentation of yourself, and on top of that, making relationships with other people. I mean, Eric Erickson has put out has done a lot of research and scholarship on that topic. And I think a lot of what these social networks are really doing is allowing teens and young adults to do the work of that time in their lives, to understand who they are. And so putting up all that information, you know, while I think it seems shocking to adults or older adults, is a part of sort of who they are and what kinds of explorations that they're doing for themselves right now in their lives.
Well, then, I'm curious, Amanda, then what would you say to a parent that, let's say, goes online and finds that their 17-year-old daughter is, you know, put up pretty private information about themselves online? How should a parent, you think, deal with that?
Well, I certainly think it's a place where you want to have a conversation with your child, and talk about exactly what about the material that you see posted is of concern to you. Talking them through why posting maybe the name of your high school, if you're still in high school, and the city that you live in, why and how that might lead to a compromise in your daughter or son's safety. You know, I think part of what's difficult about these social networks is that in many cases they encourage you to post information about yourself. And I mean, I'm looking at the MySpace page that I have, and it says, you know, Amanda, you haven't posted your school yet. So there's a sort of a, because of what the networks necessarily ask you to post, I think there's an encouragement to post perhaps more information than parents or other adults might feel comfortable, or that teens might necessarily think about posting right off the bat. But I do think that having the young person in question understand the parents' concerns and also understand the sort of network nature of the information, that you can bring pieces together to form a bigger picture, like a mosaic, as opposed to just having these separate pieces that no one will actually put together to find you. But we've actually been doing some research with young people about, we did some focus groups. And
you know what, Amanda, hold on to that thought.
Sure,
because we're up on a break, and I do want to get Fred Stutzman to comment about the pressure to post. But let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Amanda Lenhart, senior researcher at the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Fred Stutzman, a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. We invited them to join us to talk about social networking online communities for teens and young adults. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Mike McGrath. On the next You Bet Your Garden, I'll dig some expert advice out of the yard doctor, Michigan State turfgrass expert Trey Rogers, who will tell you exactly what to do to help your lawn right now, plus how to deal with bees and wasps and chemical-free answers to all your garden questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Here's some of the biggest names in entertainment, from Mariah Carey to Isaac Hayes.
I used to sing like Harlem Boys Choir. But when I reached puberty, my voice starts squeaking and cracking and breaking up. And when it smoothed out, it was down the basement.
I'm Ed Gordon. Get the inside story on News and Notes from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Before most Americans knew who the Taliban were, Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid wrote a book about them. It became a bestseller after September 11th. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Rashid about his recent reporting on Islamist militants in Afghanistan and Pakistan. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about social network communities online. They are a growing phenomenon. They include things like MySpace, Friendster, Facebook, where people post information about themselves, including bios, photos, their interests, their links to their group of friends. These social and networking communities allow users to move from site to site, leave messages, and in some cases, hook up. They are very popular with teenagers and young adults, and that's what we're exploring today on Radio Times with Amanda Lenhart and Fred Stutzman. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. If this sounds like you or someone that lives in your house, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Amanda, before we get to your research, let me just get Fred Stutzman to respond to this pressure to post that you were talking about before the break, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation as well. Fred, do you also think that there is pressure to post information online that some people might be reluctant to do?
I think it really sort of boils down to the fact that to be a whole participant in one of these systems, whether it be Facebook or MySpace, you actually have to post. You do have to post. You have to be a part of the experience where other people are sharing, so you have to share. So there is a real incentive to post. Not only does it come from the system, which sort of encourages you to post, but also the people around you who are sharing. So I do agree that there is a good amount of pressure to share information in these systems.
And are people honest, or is there any way to know that what they say is true?
Well, there really isn't any way to know, but that sort of brings up an interesting point, because a lot of times what we talk about from the security standpoint is how are these profiles going to look down the road? And even if you're sharing an in-joke now, if somebody looks at your profile a few years down the road, or somebody hiring you at a job, are they going to know the difference or even care, really? I mean, is it true just because you said it?
Anything you want to add to that, Amanda, before we get Eric from New York to join us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think certainly what's also interesting in terms of truthfulness and veracity on these sites is that a lot of young people that we've talked to, particularly with places like MySpace, which are more open, actually talk about lying on the sites to protect themselves. That they would say, we talked to some young people in Philadelphia, and some of them said, oh yeah, I say I live in Beijing. My friends know that I live in Philadelphia. The people who need to know where I live, but other people don't necessarily know where I am. So we do see some prevarication on the internet on these sites, but it's really a lot of it from a safety perspective.
So you're saying they're actually being pretty savvy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me get Eric from New York in on our conversation. Eric, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes, how are you? I'm a longtime NPR listener and a first-time caller, and the subject matter intrigues me greatly. I have been a MySpace user for about 3 years and have firsthand discovered a number of negative attributes that I, see come along with this online chatting.
Go ahead.
The first one is that I feel it's highly psychologically addictive. Many people, including myself, as soon as they wake up, before they brush their teeth and use the bathroom, they run to check their MySpace. There is a massive psychological addictive nature to this sort of online chatting. I also feel that there is a huge removal in the people's abilities now to join in on like interpersonal communication, as in person to person. There'll be, let's just communicate on MySpace. There's an uncomfortability that's now existing. I also feel that there is this new generation. It's all based on a superficiality, image-conscious group, and this sort of MySpace is totally encapsulating that sort of behavior. For example, how many friends do you have? How good is your picture? The substance of the individual is completely removed, and it is just an advertisement. And, that to me is a scary, situation that's being created in our time. And also, with MySpace...
Well, just hold on 1 second, only because you put three really good issues on the table, and I want to get our guests to respond to them. When you talk about this generation that uses MySpace, are you talking about yourself?
Well, I'm 27, okay. So I'm in the older category of this, generation, I feel. But yeah, I consider myself to be a MySpacer, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. And let me just take your points one by one, and I'll put the first one to you, Amanda Lenhart. And Eric talked about just how highly psychologically addictive he thinks these things are. Do you agree with him?
We actually don't have any research that suggests they're actually addictive by the terms that are used by people who deal with substance abuse and that sort of thing. That doesn't mean that they're not, but we haven't seen that in our own research. I will say that there is something about them that's very appealing, that brings people back. I mean, again, the young people we talk to, younger than Eric, but talk about going, many times a day, waiting a little bit for a little bit of time to go check again, so maybe somebody will have, put in a new friend request or bulletin. So there definitely is something about these sites that brings people back. And I think it gets back to, again, this desire to connect with other people, this desire to interact with people, and this desire to present yourself and materials that you've created to others.
Well, but Eric is also saying, and I'll toss this to you, Fred Stutzman, is that he thinks some of this interaction is really superficial, and it sounds almost competitive in a way.
The types of interaction that goes on in these services is unique, and it does go to the fact that these services have their own cultures. And an interesting thing that happens once you sort of start investing your time in these services is it takes a lot of time to be a good Facebook or MySpace friend. And so that sort of communication, the fact that you have to respond to messages and you have to answer friend requests, it takes up a lot of time, and it sort of places a burden on the user. And so, yeah, that may actually sort of devalue some of the communication that's going on in the services.
Do you think it also affects the kind of, literally person-to-person, face-to-face interactions that people have? This is to you, Fred, and then to you, Amanda.
I do think that it changes the dynamic. A lot of people sort of ask, does this mean that people aren't making friends offline anymore?
Right.
Has it replaced our social behavior? And to that I say no. I don't believe that's the case, because the way people use these services is largely to sort of conduct background checks on people, to investigate the people that they're becoming friends with. You only have so much time to, say, chit-chat with somebody at a party, but when you go home that night, you can Facebook them and find out all sorts of stuff about them. And so that is really interesting to people who are in this process of negotiating and building their social networks.
And I wonder, Amanda Lenhart, whether you've seen any research to say that it hurts the more person-to-person relationship between young people.
We haven't. And actually, our most recent piece of research with young people, which looked more broadly at internet interactions and online interactions versus offline interactions, we did find that young people are still spending more time offline outside of school with their friends than they are online. Mm-hmm. And that also, when asked to choose methods to communicate with people, interestingly enough to us, the landline telephone was the most favorite way of getting in touch with your friends for young people. And so I think some of these, there's still a desire, as Fred says, to connect with people face-to-face with the voice, with that kind of information, that kind of personal connection. I don't think that's going away.
Yeah.
But I do think that certainly these sites do give you additional information. It's a new way of connecting with people. It also, I think, it gives you, and I think Fred also made this point, it gives you sort of a bigger picture of the person. It's a new way to learn more about somebody. So instead of having to rehash everything when you meet them face to face, you've already seen what they posted, and so you can kind of go on from there.
I didn't even know a 16-year-old would know what a landline telephone was. I'm impressed.
They do, because it's free, because mom and dad pay for it.
Oh, there you go.
So therefore, you don't have to worry about overage charges on your cell phone if you have one.
Let me get to Barry from Chestnut Hill. And Eric, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Hope you call again. Let me get Barry from Chestnut Hill to join us. Hi, Barry. Go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank
Good.
You. Two questions. I have kids, nieces, nephews. They're all big users of both MySpace and Facebook. And especially on MySpace, I've noticed that the kids are very open to be, they're very vulgar. It sort of parallels the whole hip-hop style of language and the vulgarity that's used there, and which kind of, I'd like them to comment on that. And it leads me to the second question. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal where a kid was attempting to change his profile because he was afraid his employer would see the stuff, or his potential employer would see the stuff that he had posted. And I'm wondering, how are employers using these sources of information about potential employees?
That's a great question, Barry. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And I wonder if I could toss that back to you, Amanda Lenhart.
Sure. Well, to the vulgarity question, certainly, as I think we've talked about, these sites are where teens interact and young people interact with each other, with their peers, and it may be a side of them that their parents ordinarily might not see. But I don't think we're seeing a lot on there that doesn't go on in face-to-face interactions. As for the employers using the sites, and certainly I would love to hear what Fred has to say about this as well, my understanding is that they do use the sites. They do Google people, or they do not even Google them. They employers have ways of getting onto Facebook, even though it is an ostensibly closed system, either through alumni or other methods, and looking at how people present themselves. I've heard of instances where people have lost jobs because of how they presented themselves in this closed system. And part of the problem is that I think when people present themselves, particularly within Facebook, it's thought that you're presenting it to peers or to an audience of people who kind of know you in a particular context. It's you're not thinking about how you're presenting yourself for even your teachers or professors or for future jobs.
And a very different audience. Fred, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I think that the way you have to look at this is when you're on the Facebook, you're sort of always walking around in your pajamas. You're not walking around in your business suit. So when employers come in, they're getting a completely different picture of you. And I have seen a number of news stories where employers report that they're using things like Facebook, MySpace, and, you know, just plain old Google to find out information about candidates. And I guess that does sort of make sense. Mm-hmm. But I did hear an interesting report where employers were actually using these services to look up things that they couldn't ask in interviews. And I thought that brought a sort of new, interesting dynamic to it.
Which would be people's hobbies or their friends or their interests or all those things that show up online.
Well, even so much their religious beliefs and sexual orientation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Let me just reintroduce you both, and then we'll get back to our callers. And that's Fred Stutzman. He's a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. His research focuses on social networking, which is what we're talking about today in Radio Times. And he's co-founder of the Claim ID Project, which helps people manage what is written about them online. Also with us, Amanda Lenhart, senior researcher at the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and she specializes in youth and their use of the internet. And we are exploring social networking, these online communities that young people tend to use, sites like MySpace and Facebook and Friendster. Looks like we have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Keegan from Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Keegan. Go ahead, your Radio
Hi,
Times.
Marty.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I just wanted to make a point that before there was MySpace and Friendster, there were sites that the gay community visited. I'm 30 years old, and my first experience with an online profile site was when I was in college 10 years ago.
And what was it called?
Yeah, it was gay.com, and it's still here today. And it has taken off and branched off into all these other companies. And predominantly, the main purpose for these sites is for men to hook up online. And I just find it very disconcerting because I really don't think it adds, I just don't think it promotes a healthy lifestyle. And I mean, I have a profile on Friendster right now. And again, people go there not only just to look up friends, like your guest has said, like to find further information on social media at a party, but a lot of people spend time on that. Instead of going out and meeting people, they spend time at home trying to meet people physically online to make a connection and a hookup.
Well, and Keegan, I mean, there are plenty of sites that are doing that, and that's certainly a piece of what we're talking about. I'd be curious what our guests say in response to your comments, and thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And Fritz Husman, do you share some of Keegan's concerns about how people are using some of these online services?
I think he does make a number of valid points about how people use online services for meeting other people. I think the critical difference is the fact that these networks have become so pervasive, whereas a couple of years ago, you actually had to sort of go out of your way to have a profile online. You had to sort of make that leap, not only of faith, but you had to go out and find a service to be a part of. But now, if you look at the statistics, you see these services are being used sort of by everyone. 95% utilization by the freshmen here at UNC Chapel Hill. So we're not really talking about a self-selected population anymore. We're talking about everyone. And because of that, the dynamic does change a little bit. But I think there are uses that come along with the Internet that are sort of outside of our traditional uses. And, finding people to hook up with may be one of them.
And should we be surprised by that, Amanda Linhart?
I don't think so. I mean, certainly I think what people use the Internet for overall in general and these social networks is for things that they were doing offline. They're moving these kinds of behaviors into an online context. And so just as people have always been looking for people to meet and in some cases to hook up with offline, now they have a way to do it. And in some ways it's even more efficient. And so it's not surprising. You know, think about online dating sites, which by some constructions are social networks as well, where
sure.
people go because they want to meet other people who want to meet other people. It's a similar sort of thing for what, you know, our caller was talking about with gay.com. You want to go someplace where you're going to meet other people who are there for the same reason. So instead of having to, you know, find a physical space where that's happening, you can actually go to an online space that transcends geography and have those and engage in those kind of activities.
Keegan, thanks for the call. Let's see what Pat from Marlton has to say. Pat, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point regarding kids thinking that they're protecting their identity but kind of inadvertently giving it out. I had the experience of just Google searching my local swim club, and I was really surprised that the first two hits on the Google search were two kids that I knew from the swim club. They were with their pictures and their MySpace, and they thought they were just talking about their hobbies and that they swam at this local swim club, but they were out there on the Google search just by searching for the name of the club.
And were they saying anything that you think was, put them at risk or was shocking to you in any way, Pat?
Well, I think what, for me, it showed the kid's picture and then it said, you know, the Woodstream Swim Club in Marlton, New Jersey. So how hard would it be for somebody surfing the Internet to find these kids?
Well, let me get to Amanda Linhart to respond to your concerns. Pat, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Amanda, this gets us back to, you know, how and what kids should do to protect themselves online and whether there's a certain level of naivete when posting information about yourself.
I mean, certainly there is a disconnect between what you want to do with these sites and protecting yourself online. I mean, the fun part of being on these sites is being able to connect with your school friends. Mm-hmm. And how do people who you don't know that well in your school find you? They find you by searching for the name of your school. Same thing with a swim club or, you know, a track team or a softball team or any other kind of extracurricular activity. And by doing that, however, you do put yourself at risk, particularly when you're talking about a physical place. That if you say, you know, I swim the backstroke at this particular swim club, and you post your picture, somebody who is interested in coming to find you can come to that swim club and track you down. And most of the young people that we talk to, getting back to some of the research that we did, really do, we ask them about sort of levels of privacy and MySpace and Facebook and online social networks. And they said for them the big thing was not putting up information that would allow them to be physically contacted. That was the real thing that most teens said they were thinking about. Now, sometimes there was a disconnect. You know, we said, well, don't you think somebody can find you if you post your school name? And there was a kind of an, oh. Yeah.
Interesting.
But for the most part, young people don't see a problem with posting a picture as long as you don't say where you are. So they try to make a balance between sharing information about themselves and connecting with the people they want to connect with while still trying to protect themselves. And sometimes it's not perfect.
Well, I'll tell you what, another short break, then we'll get back to our guests and to our callers. And we are talking about social networking, some of these online communities like MySpace and Friendster, Facebook, very popular among teenagers and young adults. We're talking about the benefits and the risks. And that's Amanda Linhart, senior researcher at the Pew Internet and American Life Project. Also with us is Fred Stutzman, a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Peter Sagal. Tune in to hear veteran newsman Carl Castle relax and let his hair down on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day, the federal government wants to let students reveal their entire racial backgrounds on school forms.
For someone of Japanese, English, and Russian Jewish heritage, failure to count me as less than a whole member of each of these communities is inaccurate.
But is there such a thing as too much information? Dealing with data and diversity next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Our middle schools becoming a thing of the past. Also, a journalist makes the case for impeaching President Bush. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now. Today at noon on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, 10,000 Villages, Satterton, hosting an Oriental Rug event September 13th through 16th with fairly traded hand-knotted Oriental rugs. 215-723-1221 or rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Let's get back to our callers, and we've got Mesh from Flemington. Mesh, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I've seen, in my experience, a lot of strife being caused between friends through MySpace and other similar sites. Apparently, in this modern era, you know, you're only allowed to have 8 friends because there's a thing on MySpace known as your top 8. And, you know, the bickering that goes back and forth continuously from comments like, I'm not on your top 8, those comments you left, it seems to me... it's 50% positive, 50% negative. I have lost just as many friends as I have gained. And it's just really comical running joke I have that in 2005, 2006, you're only allowed 8 friends. And it's just intriguing to me to see how this has caused so much discontent among friends as well as the positive.
Well, I'm glad you called, Mesh, because I think you raise a really important point. And let me toss that first to you, Fred Stutzman. Do you think he's right in that, yes, it's a great social network, but you lose as many friends as you gain?
I don't know if I'd completely agree with that point, but I do think that sort of looking at this a little bit more broadly, these sites do force new responsibilities on keeping up relationships. So sort of as I alluded to prior, taking that time every day to answer your messages and your friend requests, and particularly this top 8 phenomenon, which is you only get to choose 8 friends which are on your profile in MySpace, and actually you can sort of order them, so you can have these top 8 friends. It does create somewhat of a, I think, psychological burden among these young people who, you know, I want to be on your top 8, but you didn't have me on, you know, that sort of thing. So I think it does create somewhat of a burden, and it does sort of introduce new challenges to maintaining relationships.
Do you see, Amanda, you know, trash talk and conflict online?
Certainly. I think there's been, you know, a fair amount of research that suggests that people say things online that they might not otherwise say, partly because of the fact that it's a mediated way of communicating with somebody, that you don't have a lot of visual or even auditory clues that tell you how what you're saying is being received. So particularly with the teenagers that we talk to, but I think this also applies to adults, that a lot of times you'll say things on the internet that maybe you wouldn't have said, and you say it in a way that gets misunderstood. And so there's not as much information around what you're saying to give people a way of knowing how to react to it. And so it's certainly, while that's bad for some things, it's good for other kinds of conversations when you maybe don't want to say things. You need to say something that's going to be hard to say. But certainly we have heard a lot about the strife that we have. And, you know, the top 8 friends is certainly, as Fred points out, it is a burden. Mm-hmm. It does require you to pick people and make judgments about people that you may not want to make. But it strikes me that it's sort of a lot like picking bridesmaids for your wedding. I mean, how do you go about doing that as well? So there are other places where we have to make these kinds of choices. But MySpace is a new one in the digital era.
Well, having looked at MySpace, it looks like a lot of people, they'll break those rules because I saw people with, you know, 187 friends.
Oh, certainly. Well, you can have more friends than the 8. You just only get to show 8 on your page.
I gotcha. Let me get to Corey. And Mesh, thanks for the call. Let me get Corey from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Corey. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that there's a lot of drawbacks with MySpace and safety. I think just aside that goes, thanks for a great show, by the way.
Oh, you're welcome.
I think that comes down to parental awareness first and foremost. But MySpace does have a vast music section. You know, hundreds and thousands and hundreds of thousands of profiles that allow, say, bedroom musicians, people that kind of record themselves and to get out there and have a website that's free for them to post their songs and people can go and refer to that. I think that's an important part that's kind of rarely discussed, the section of MySpace that's called MySpace Music. And that's kind of the comment I wanted to make. Thank you.
Corey, before you go, I mean, have you posted some of your own music then on your
groups that I've been in that I've posted, and I kind of just make sure that if there's anything posted about myself, that I approve of it. And as well as kind of the general content of the page, but, you know, I've never run into anything that I would see as being, negative about myself as a result of that. So.
Fair enough. No, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Amanda Lenhardt, I mean, it is interesting that there is this music component, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised about that either, only because, you know, kids love music.
Well, absolutely, and I think that's definitely something that's more a part of MySpace than on Facebook. MySpace has a really great integration with being able to play songs on your profile, and MySpace actually started as a way of being able to help people learn about new bands and help bands promote themselves to people online, and actually even today, it is an extremely powerful place for bands and musicians to really gain a lot of recognition to get people to listen to their music who might not have ever listened to it before, because they would never hear it on the radio. So certainly MySpace is an extremely powerful tool in that regard, and has been responsible for making the careers of some musicians.
Sure. Anything you want to add to that, Fred, before we get back to our callers?
I think it's very interesting how MySpace has integrated itself into our popular culture. And I think sort of what I mean by that is it's very common for artists, musicians, and comedians, and that sort of stuff, to have MySpace profiles. And it's sort of interesting because it allows people to become friends with the people that they're fans of. And as a result, I think it's sort of leveling the distance between normal people and stars. So it's sort of an interesting thing that's going on there.
And it's also replaced the flyer, I would think, in many ways as well, if a band is performing.
That's right. I actually know a number of bands who use MySpace heavily to promote their upcoming shows. And because of the non-geographic nature of MySpace, they've built fan bases that are outside of their sort of local areas that they could flyer.
And that's Fred Stutzman. He's a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. And his research focuses on social networking. That's the topic of our conversation today on Radio Times. He's also co-founder of the Claim ID Project, which helps people manage what is written about them online. Amanda Lenhardt, our other guest, a senior researcher at the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and she specializes in youth and their use of the Internet. Let me get Suzanne from Philadelphia to join us. Corey, thanks for the call. Suzanne, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi, I'm a high school senior, and I use Facebook a lot. But I was intrigued when Fred talked about using it for background checks on your friends, because that's certainly true, but I disagree, because also people use Facebook to create just Facebook-only relationships with people who you might be, you know, intimidated to talk to face-to-face in real life, just kind of construct a relationship based entirely on posts on their walls, or even, you know, move to texting on cell phones. And, you know, I wonder if it's a trend in kind of adolescent relationships that are moving towards a more casual realm instead of the face-to-face talking.
And, Fred, you want to take that first, and then we'll hear from Amanda.
Sure. I think there are some really valid points there. And if you walk around a college campus, you'll notice that a lot of students are on their cell phones, but they're not talking on their cell phones, they're texting each other. It's very popular for students to have this sort of low-involvement communication between themselves. So I think her point is very reflective of that. Rather than having this having an interaction where you have to be face-to-face, it's much easier for you to leave a message on a wall or text on a cell phone. I think it's a trend that's becoming very powerful and popular among the young audience.
And Amanda gives so many choices to a person about how you want to communicate with somebody else.
Well, absolutely. I mean, these particular networks that we're talking about often have multiple ways built in to communicate with people. And we're actually seeing some of young people's communication actually migrate away from sort of standalone applications like an email program or an IM program and into the social networking sites. But certainly I think this idea of Facebook-only relationships or MySpace-only relationships is an expansion of things that we saw with instant messaging as well in years past, where people were able to maintain relationships that otherwise might have petered out. So think like maybe friends you made at summer camp or people who moved away. These are the kinds of relationships that can be fostered and can be maintained because of, as I think Fred used this fabulous term, low-involvement communication, that
right.
It doesn't really take a lot of effort to send a text message or to send an IM or to post something on somebody's wall.
But keeps you connected.
Exactly.
Even at this sort of low-grade level. Hey, Suzanne, before we say goodbye to you, I'm just curious. You said you're a high school senior?
Yeah.
And how long have you had, you know, been using Facebook for?
Probably about half a year. All of a sudden, it just kind of blossomed at my school, and, you know, within a week, everyone had it.
are you on it every day? Are you updating it? Are you communicating?
Usually I'll go on once a day. Updating, that's kind of only when you have new photos or
right.
something. But, you know, it is a good way just to keep in touch with people who you don't have a strong enough relationship to go out and see during the summer.
Well, it sounds like you've underscored some of the things that our guests had to say on Radio Times. Thanks for calling into the show.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome. Let me get to Madeline from Philadelphia to join us. Madeline, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My question has to do with a different danger I find with my son, and that is with grades. Because schools assign, you know, a certain amount of homework on the computer, it's very difficult for a parent to draw the line to know when they're actually doing work. And I find the conversations on MySpace go on during the entire homework time. And I also find that my son will say that he has computer work when he really just wants to sort of be on the computer talking. I wondered if their research uncovered any, maybe this was a good question for your last caller, but whether they uncovered any difficulties with schoolwork, because I know that when I was growing up, I would have been on the phone. If I could have been on the phone
sure.
doing homework, I would have been on the phone. So this is like much easier for the kid to do while he's doing his homework. Did they find anything? Or?
Yeah, you know, Amanda, I think it's actually a good question for Madeline, a good question for Amanda Lenhart. I'm sure you've looked at that, haven't you, Amanda?
Well, certainly we have looked at, how much time young people are spending on various applications, whether it's IM, whether it's social networks. And certainly these are extremely popular, extremely sticky. I mean, you want to keep coming back to these applications. You want to check them frequently. And they do take up time. And certainly young people, when we ask them about this, do point to what they consider to be their facility with multitasking. You know, they say, hey, you know what, I can do both of these things. I think some parents disagree. Some teachers also disagree when they reflect that in their grades. So I think it really depends on the person and the child and what they're doing. All I can say is that, I heard from a major ISP that, you know, in their sort of child and parent controls, the most unblocked site is MySpace.
Oh.
So certainly parents themselves have options for keeping their kids from going there if they don't want them to go there. But in many cases, you know, you don't want your child to be cut off from this place of social interaction and socialization. So it's a tough call because they certainly do need to use the computer for their homework, and they're probably it's going to be hard to keep them off of these technologies.
And I'm assuming, Fred Stutzman, that's also true at the college level?
Yeah, I believe it is. And the thing is about these services, the main sort of point of interaction in any of these social networking services is the individual, it's the friend. And so, you know, to make a very broad generalization, the things that sort of matter the most to young people are their friend networks. So being on these sites and you know, having relationships in them is just so important to them that it's almost more important than anything else. And because of the way they can actualize and realize friendships in these services, it really has a very strong motivation for young people to use it. So I'm not entirely surprised to see students really going out of their way to make time to be on these services because they're just so important to them.
And I guess the question from a parent is, you know, are they getting their homework done and are they taking care of the rest of their life?
That's a very good question. I don't have the answer for
I don't either. I'm just glad I don't have to do homework anymore. Let me get to Gwen from Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Gwen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been hearing a lot of negative comments about MySpace, and there was a caller that called in about networking abilities of MySpace in terms of music, in terms of independent bands trying to, promote themselves. But there's also separate organized groups that you can join, such as political groups, cultural, entertainment. I mean, there's a a whole plethora of different groups that you can join in terms of networking. And it also provides a way of self-expression for the individual,
sure,
for example.
Sure.
And there's a lot of concern as well about the kids nowadays maybe spending more time on the internet with the MySpace, for example, overwhelmingly, and it might interfere with their homework, for example. But because it's a low grade communication, as people have been mentioning, it's a casual way to communicate,
sure,
just like text messaging or IM, for example.
Well, you know what,
they
Gwen?
Can do the same thing on email.
Let me just stop you there, only because, and I don't want people to go away with the impression that somehow we were denigrating these things. It's really a chance to explore it, and what I hear from both of our guests is a great deal of interest and actually enthusiasm for some of these online networking communities. But let me just give Amanda Lenhardt a chance to respond to your comments. And Gwen, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Okay.
Any final thoughts, Amanda?
Well, I think, you know, Gwen is absolutely right. The thing about MySpace that's so wonderful is the ability to express yourself and the ability to do that in a way that connects you with other people. I mean, that's really what brings people back, and that's why these places are so popular. It meets needs that teens have in their lives, things that they really want to do, and I think that's part of their popularity. Of course, there's always the tension with revealing yourself to other people and sharing yourself. Sometimes you're sharing yourself with people you don't want to be sharing with, and I think that's, you know, a tension inherent in these sites.
And Fred, you got 20 seconds, final word.
I just think that it's amazing to watch how these sites are going to sort of proliferate and become part of a more normal way of viewing technology. I just think that in the future, we're all sort of going to connect this way.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Fred Stutzman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Amanda Lenhardt, thank you as well.
Oh, thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. And we appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. Interesting calls to the program. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can leave us an email and find out about podcasts of the program and other information about the program as well. Debbie Builder, Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produced the program this week. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. You're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.